CliffCentral.com. Yes, that's Cheat Codes and Little Mix with Only You. It is just about 7 o'clock, CliffCentral.com. Are you ready to start your day? What's wrong, Sia?
No, I just had to think about it for a second. You know, we don't live in the age of grand superstars anymore. I know the name Little Mix. I'll never be able to
Little
pick
Mix,
them in the lineup.
I'll tell you how people. I know about Little Mix. Little Mix is in trouble because Little Mix is white, but Little Mix grew dreadlocks.
Oh, what?
And was accused of cultural appropriation.
Are you talking about the right thing here?
But yes. I've seen a lot of white people.
Little Mix is a group of like four or five girls.
No. This was one of the girls in Little Mix, the lead singer.
Oh.
She grew dreadlocks, and now she's been accused of cultural appropriation. So she apologized. And, you know, it's the most bizarre thing, this cultural appropriation.
It's gone too far.
I don't want to go down this path so early in the morning because it's annoying to me. But cultural appropriation is what we all live for. I mean, don't you want, like, a great Italian meal? Imagine if I accused you of cultural appropriation if you were eating, you know,
if you said you were going to an Italian
pizza
restaurant.
Yeah. if imagine sushi is cultural appropriation.
Well,
accents, the way people's accents, the way people dress.
How about Latin dancing?
Yeah.
What about weaves?
Yeah.
Is that not? Because I often hear some, and really, I hear some black people say like, oh no, that person has braids, that's cultural appropriation. Well, honey, you have someone's hair from Malaysia on your head.
Yeah. Look,
I don't know if you can equate the two, but
cultural appropriation
doesn't make sense.
Dumbest thing I've ever heard of in my life. And also, you should be appropriating other cultures. You should be enhancing yourself by appropriating as much of other culture as you can. Anyway, that's all I know about Little Mix. You brought it up.
No,
look what you did.
When Diana Ross was mentioned, you knew who Diana Ross was. When Michael Jackson was mentioned.
Okay, I see what you mean.
I think, you know, Little Mix, and there's Little Yachty, and there's Big Papa and Big Mother.
But none of these are huge superstars.
We don't know these people anymore. No.
Like okay. You wouldn't know Little Mix if she jumped out of your Rice Krispies.
Mm. No.
I got you.
And her hologram will soon enough. I don't know.
Probably. Patricia DeLille, has she named her party yet?
Yes, she has.
What?
And people are saying that she should have Googled her campaign name.
Well, what is it?
It's called For Good. One word. Forgood.
But that already belongs to someone else.
Exactly. There's already a For Good in South Africa. There has been for many years.
There must be about 2,000 different charities all over the place that are called For Good.
Mm. But For Good itself says, you know, we're very established. We don't mind the newcomer campaign all that much. We can turn the confusion to good.
All right. But so, Patricia, if she'd just gone online and just done a quick Google search, she would have realized she can't use that name. It's registered already, right?
So, the CEO of For Good, Andy Hadfield, said, "We think this shows it's really important to Google competitor names before you launch projects. But they said they're going to have some fun with it and use the opportunity to drive more people to more good causes.
Okay, so are they a charity, the For Good that have existed?
A social
before?
Enterprise.
Oh, okay.
They've been around since 2010, and in 2015, they relaunched as a way to connect people to causes, and to date, it has recorded more than 22,000 such connections. Hmm. So right now, it's helping Hospice Rustenburg to find donations of sanitary pads, Iris House Children's Hospice to find donations of nappies, etc. So.
Okay. It's a stupid name, though, because nobody believes a political party could do anything good.
Well, For Good, the political platform,
yeah,
is looking for people to join by giving it their email addresses and phone numbers.
Uh-oh.
And so becoming one of the good people, it says it will fight for good people.
Hmm. All right.
May I ask, did Patricia also start ID?
Yeah, the
all those years ago?
Independent Democrats, yeah.
With a track record, then you want to start for good. I'm looking at you like, okay, no.
Well, I mean, this would be like, you know what she should really do is she should get together with Mampela Rampele, and then the two of them can have a party that will last just one more election cycle and disappear.
We've just gotten over the kiss between Zille and Mampela, like we don't need.
Yeah. What happened to them? Ahang. Do you think anybody would vote for them ever again? Ahang and ID, and who were the other ones? There was another one as well, wasn't there?
Makosi Khoza was...
Oh, shame. What happened to her?
Exactly. She also started her own party.
Tell you what, when we lost Jacob Zuma, we lost a lot of his important detractors.
There must be a slicker, smarter way of being able to do something. And perhaps, Patricia, you could have just sat in your house for a while.
A little bit of brainstorming.
Yeah, have a smarter position. I don't know. Elsewhere.
So I don't know if you know about this, but yesterday was a big day for the state capture inquiry. They had Pravin Gordhan,
who was
busy testifying, and Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan has hit back at the EFF, calling for Floyd Shivambu to tell South Africans who finances his and the EFF's leadership's lifestyles. Shivambu made several allegations against Gordhan on Monday when he addressed the EFF members picketing in Parktown, Johannesburg, where the latter was appearing before his commission of inquiry into state capture. Shivambu said one of his allegations was that Gordhan's immediate task after his appointment by President Cyril Ramaphosa was to destroy Eskom and SAA so that they could eventually be privatized. He also alleged that Pravin had used the spy tapes in 2009 to strong-arm former President Jacob Zuma into appointing him as finance minister. He had private intelligence called the Rogue Unit. He was the one who gathered the so-called spy tapes. He was the one who used those tapes to go and bargain with Jacob Zuma to say, we'll give you the tapes, drop the corruption charges, and then you must assign me as the Minister of Finance, argued Shivambu. In rejecting the allegations, Gordon's spokesperson Adrian Lekay said Shivambu must take South Africans into his confidence about his finances. It's time that Mr. Shivambu explained to South Africa, and in particular the people of Limpopo, when money was stolen from VBS Mutual Bank and when it will be repaid. It is time for him to disclose what other sources of income funds his own lifestyle and that of other leadership figures in the EFF. Well, that's a good point. Shouldn't we know that stuff?
Yeah.
Lekay also called for Shivambu to subject himself before the commission chaired by Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo to present any evidence about Pravin Gordhan that he might have. But of course that won't happen because all that Floyd is doing is making a noise. It's all he's good at. So I wouldn't hold my breath if I were you. But how's that? We should really... Don't you want to know every cent that politicians earn? I mean, they are public figures. If they were private individuals, you know, if you go up to the guy who owns his own little plumbing business, you have no business finding out how he funds his lifestyle, how many toilets he's repaired, how many geysers he's fixed. It's none of your business. But if you're a public official, we are allowed to know everything because we get to vote for you and we get to put you in a position which could enable you to line up all kinds of lucrative tenders. And we need to know what kind of an honest or dishonest person you are before you go into politics. It's not asking too much, right?
Yeah. Just an update quickly on the Patricia DeLille thing.
Yes.
I've seen now DeLille has told Business Insider, For Good is not the name of the party.
Oh.
It's a call to action for good South Africans to join a movement for good. We will announce the name in the next 2 weeks. So she's saying that this is the campaign around it.
Oh, Patricia.
And For Good has a website, forgood.org.za. But it's the campaign around the new party.
I bet you it was the name.
Yeah, it was. And now she's trying to make it seem like it wasn't.
To backtrack.
No, that's not what I meant.
So you mentioned a little earlier about the fact that we should know where all of the politicians' money goes and how much they spend, et cetera.
More importantly, where they get it from.
Well, if we're talking about money, there's a new trend with the rich and the elite of the world, which is very interesting. David Forbes from Forbes magazine says there was a time when people really flaunted their wealth. Now they don't. So Forbes has done a new investigation into what they're now calling under the radar living.
Yes.
This is what the richest of the rich are now truly doing. Like, gone are the days of a flashy Lamborghini, of private jets all over the place. Rich people are now saying, nah, we are not about that right now. There are new trends with the elite. Some people are actually blocking GPS from locating property with the likes of jamming signals. Some rich people have removed their homes from the grid, and others have even hired architects to conceal buildings. So in this whole investigation, which I find really, really fascinating, one of the trends that they've noticed among the super rich are underground homes.
Yeah, people are embarrassed about their wealth now.
Yeah. And one of the most expensive properties in the U.S. right now, it was listed for $185 million, was largely an underground home. So this, you can dig deep well into the ground. I'm sure there are restrictions, though.
Sure.
But also, you can be very private about what you're doing. Who knows what you're doing when you're rich? You might have a home brothel going on down there. No one can tell.
Brothel.
Who knows?
See, and now we know what you would do if you had money.
Just underneath the ground, and that's it. But also, what Forbes is seeing with this trend of underground homes specifically is that the rich are very fearful of their lives and of their safety. So amongst this whole underground mansion trend are panic rooms underneath the ground. So if they were ever to be under attack, some people are spending up to $500,000 to build panic rooms underground. And even the likes of Zuckerberg is seeing and realizing this. He's boosted up his security from $3 million a year to now $10 million a year. That's just for him and his family.
Do you know really, really rich people?
I've come across them.
You know the 6 degrees of separation thing? I think probably like with 2 degrees. I know. What are
but
we
like
talking?
We're talking dollar billionaires.
Dollar billion. Mm-hmm. Oh. So I actually met. Yeah, I was right with that. 2 degrees. I actually met someone on Friday who knows of someone originally a South African, now living in the U.S. You can't even find them on Google, because we tried this out on Friday when their name was mentioned. They have made so much of their money through music rights. So they sit and they do nothing. They've bought part of Michael Jackson's catalog. They don't own all of it, because I think Paul McCartney does. And they started out just in South Africa, owning the likes of Brenda Fassie's music rights and. And he now happily lives in the U.S. You cannot find him.
But you can't
anywhere.
Find him. So this is why I'm asking.
Mm. This whole under the radar
thing. Yeah. People, you see, you can only guess at someone's asset value if they either own shares in a listed company or if they've disclosed all their tax returns publicly, like if they were going for a public office. Otherwise, you don't really know. You don't know what Bill Gates is actually worth. Forbes have to do a thumbsuck based on what he owns, what he's done, what his company's worth.
Mm.
You don't really know. And the really, really rich people, you don't know anything about them. Anything.
Ooh.
That is serious money. If someone has a flashy car and a big house and wears a lot of jewelry, they're probably not that rich. They probably don't have a lot.
Mm.
Yeah.
The really rich people, you don't even notice them.
It's both admirable and very mysterious.
It's mysterious, right?
How much are you hiding?
Really, really rich people don't walk around with tiaras on and mink coats and hop into expensive cars and they quietly just do their thing.
So do this as a bit of an investigation from what Forbes has done. If you just Google Sea Island in Georgia, this is
Sea Island, S-E-A?
S-E-A Island in Georgia. And you go to your Google Maps or whatever the case is, you cannot get any street views of this neighborhood.
Really?
So this is, you know, the average home there costs $3.2 million. And all of these people have banded up together saying, no, we don't want this.
Sea Island is a privately owned, unincorporated area of Glynn County, Georgia, part of the Golden Isles of Georgia, including St. Simon's Island, Jekyll Island, Little St. Simon's Island, and the mainland city of Brunswick.
can't find anything there.
Population only 298.
Hmm. Fabulous.
Mm, so
there's
nice.
A 5-star resort there. Okay. Sea Island.
Supposedly a lot of PGA golfers live there. So Paul McCartney also lives in a similar neighborhood where you cannot find any pictures, any street view pictures of houses. And really? You also noted things about cars. If you look at some of the world's most richest people, they drive regular cars. Because as well, going back to under the radar living, but also security issues. Yeah. You know, if someone is driving around in a Maserati, you already have your interest piqued. But the likes of VWs and Hondas are seeing a trend. And they've spoken, Forbes has spoken exclusively to some head honchos there. They'll get, you know, billionaires, dollar billionaires who'll buy a fleet of Honda cars just to drive around in. And that's your $30,000.
Yeah, in other words, they don't want to be in some fancy car and have people know that they're rich. They'll drive around in Hondas with billions and billions of dollars.
But a lot of people are rich because they drive around in Hondas and not Maseratis.
No, you're probably right.
Good point, well put. The trend of flying private also is dwindling down slightly, with more dollar billionaires opting to fly commercially. But that doesn't mean they don't factor in some sort of comfort for themselves. So private suites at airports are becoming the new in thing, where these rich people will have their own separate entrances to the airport, mm-hmm. where they'll also go through, you know, the likes of security. They'll get to check in and they'll be able to chill alone privately, and they'll be driven straight onto the tarmac, and they'll walk right up to the plane first before everyone else starts to board. So just check. Next time you're complaining about leg room, just glance at the person next to you. You could be
sitting
next
to
a
super
billionaire.
Rich person. All right.
Ooh, life of the rich
very
and famous,
exciting.
Folks.
Huh. Mm. All right. Apparently, bras, this is something I didn't know that Leanne brought up yesterday, push-up bras are starting to be less of a thing. People are less interested in push-up bras and showing off their cleavage and making it look like they have enormous, great big titters.
Have we discovered Victoria's Secret?
Well, this is it. Profits are apparently plunging at Victoria's Secret.
Oh, no. This is very bad news.
As a proudly braless look takes hold. Oh, the world's most fashionable boobs are now no longer in your face. So, if you...
Just like wealthy people are not in your face anymore, so
if
the boobs.
If you've been looking at, you know, Fashion Week and catwalks, a lot of the flat, you know, chested look is in, with maybe just a, what they call a boob tube.
Right.
Over them.
I haven't heard that term since the 90s.
Yeah, a very long time. But last week's New York fashion show has been, or not last week, it was about, 2 weeks ago, it has been overshadowed by comments made by its boss, Ed Ruzick, for which he has since apologized, about how it would be inappropriate to cast transsexuals in a show about fantasy. Profits, sales, and market share have fallen over the past year, and then now this has all come to this point where he's made a bit of a faux pas. But you know, all breasts are beautiful. Some are more fashionable than others, though.
No, not all of them are beautiful. I dispute that completely.
Yeah, let's just
come on.
I'm trying to be, you know, politically correct. The scaffolded cleavage, where it's all sort of hoiked and cantilevered, and
so in other
with
words,
the push-up bra,
fake.
Yeah, where you've got these sort of twin globes. Mm-hmm. That is still the style at Victoria's Secret, but on the New York catwalk, Gigi Hadid, for instance, wore a shiny blue check bra with matching knickers, a billowing tartan cape, and a bum bag in the style of a sporran.
A bum bag.
It's just generally flatter, more natural, braless. Lady Gaga cover of Vogue recently was kind of leaning forward a bit.
Involved. No. I don't like this at all.
Well, what? You prefer the sculptured big boob look?
No, I just think, you know what? Let's not say flat is better. Let's go to extremes.
It's more fashionable. I mean, let's face it, big bums are more fashionable now.
Yeah, that part I know. Can't argue with that anymore.
What do I do with my flat bum, you know? Which used to be...
I got a flat bum too. I feel your pain.
Well, I have 2 points on this. Firstly, why are we taking trends and tips from a company that makes diamond-encrusted bras? Victoria's Secret, the reason why your sales aren't going well is because you sell diamond-encrusted bras. Sell something that more people can afford to buy, then that would be different. But then secondly, the practicality of a bra, isn't there... Leanne, a practicality to
it? There is a practicality, definitely for me. I mean, I can't even speak on the phone if I don't have a bra and can't even concentrate.
What happens if you don't have a bra?
I just feel naked. It's horrible. It's like speaking to your boss while you're naked and you've just got out of the shower. It feels awful.
Because you have pretty enormous breasts, so you never go around braless.
No. And if I do, it's actually more comfortable to be hoisted up.
See? The practicality of it.
But that's in public. Alone, it's more comfortable to not have a bra.
Sure. Do you walk around your house with free swinging?
Yeah. I was in Standard 5, which is Grade 7, and we had those little autograph books at the end of primary school.
Yeah.
And in my one, because I was already wearing a bra from like Standard 3.
Enormous breasts at a young age.
Someone had written in there, some young boy, some girls wear bras, some girls wear strings, but poor old Leanne just lets them swing.
Kids are so
Didn't you at
horrible.
One stage, I remember you telling me you wanted to get a breast reduction.
Yeah. Yeah, I still would. But, you know.
At this age?
Yeah, definitely. What age?
No. As in, like, you've lived with them as a
I'll report you to the police if you do that.
I still would do it.
Really?
But, you know, it costs a lot of money. It's painful. They're scarring.
And medical aid doesn't cover it. And
yeah. Well, no, mine would.
Why? It's a health issue?
Yeah.
Oh.
Back,
big time.
Back sore. Mm-hmm. Back soreness. All of that sort of thing.
See? Okay, there's always a means and a way about it. But I don't like this trend. Don't do it. Just call it a day.
I've seen people ruin themselves through the years where fashion has changed. I remember when really thin eyebrows were all the rage and people had permanent hair removal, and now they're filling them in with pencils and things. You know, it's just like, don't change your body for fashion, really.
Would you ever go, I mean, do you have one of those sports bras? Do you like those? Do you use the old-fashioned ones? Like, what kind?
You've seen mine before, because we put Damon in one of my bras and we put potatoes in it.
Potatoes in there. Yeah. I still have that picture somewhere.
We tried to figure out how many potatoes would fit into Leanne's bra. I remember that.
Yeah. So, no, pretty feminine bras. And then I do have a sports bra as well.
So which are the more comfortable ones?
None.
Are they all awful to wear? I mean, you know, you always see these women. Is it true that a lot of women are walking around in bras that don't actually fit them right?
Exactly. So I go to a person who fits them properly. I go to a studio. So, for instance, when I was buying bras like normal,
see, we don't
in
understand.
Department stores.
We, as men, we never ever wear anything like anything remotely like that. There's nothing like that.
When I was buying normal bras, I remember I was wearing a 38D, and I went for a proper fitting, and I'm actually a 32 double G.
Double G? Sweet Jesus.
So, yeah, what happens is people tend to buy the wrong measurement, which is under the boobs, because the cup gets bigger. It gets placed differently.
Yes.
But
tell me more. I could listen to this all day. I'm fascinated by this.
This is such a new world to me.
Yes.
Centuries, my dear.
I also only found out recently. This is probably in a couple of months ago. How expensive bras are. Because you can't compare it to, it really isn't a fair comparison, but you can't compare it to guys buying underwear.
No.
Yeah,
you know,
no.
An average bra, how much would you say that is?
Well, I don't know, because I don't buy average bras. But like mine can be up to 1,000 rand a bra.
Oh!
When you walk in, you're gonna cause some issues. All that 14-year-old boys will need a few more tissues. Press on the news desk, so box them. The headline today reads, I wanna touch some great big mama wrigglers.
That's Nathan and the Lone Hill State dudes.
Yes.
They did that for you.
That timing was perfect.
Jugs and orbs and darts and gourds, Elmer Fudds and bouncing Buddhas, sweater stretchers, lung protectors, beach umbrellas, frost detectors, Scooby snacks and snake eyes dice, Jell-O molds and high beam lights. Every day I probably use 99 words for boobs.
That's right. There's a version. There are about 100 versions I've got of songs that people wrote for you about your enormous pendulous breasts.
Oh, the admiration
the most
of it all.
Famous boobs in South African media. There we are.
That is what should be.
I can't add to that.
That's your one line.
My tagline.
Yeah. It's terrific. I am Leanne Moore.
Yeah. It's great. Good for you.
Wow.
All right, so no chopping them off then.
Nope. Well, I mean, you don't want to fiddle with that stuff. You said it yourself.
Yeah.
You know what? You're used to them as well. Do you sleep on them ever? Or do you have to sleep on your back? I mean, you're not Dolly Parton.
When I sleep on my back, they end up at my sides anyway.
What?
Well, think about it.
I've never... Oh, gravities. My goodness.
What do you think? It's going to happen.
I remember being on holiday and a friend of mine came from the other room and... When we woke up in the morning and she put her head on my chest, just, you know, relaxing. And she was like, where are your boobs?
Like they're on the sides.
Okay, last question. Really, I'm only asking this because I'm so fascinated. How does it feel when someone punches you in the boobs?
Oh.
Have you ever had that?
I've never had anyone punch me in my boobs.
Well, we don't want to. Okay. But it isn't like this, you know, guys getting punched in the balls.
No, going through when you're developing at a young age, then it's like really painful.
Mm.
Yeah, but now, ugh.
What do you say, Nola?
They've rubberized.
Quietly. Isn't this a fascinating insight into Leanne's life?
I've been punched in the boobs.
You have?
Oh. Yeah.
By whom?
I don't know, some random guy I was sparring with.
Oh my god,
I think.
Really? When you were boxing?
No, we were sparring at the dojo.
Oh, okay,
and
right.
Ooh, I guess it's because I don't really have boobs. I don't even have a bra size. So, it would
yeah,
be
listen,
different.
I think, just to go back to the whole thing, the comparison that Sia was making between like underwear for men and bras. Like if you're wearing the wrong kind of fit in either of those places...
Mm.
It's uncomfortable. You are not able to focus. You're not able to concentrate. It distracts you. You've got to look after yourself. Spend a little bit of money because it's worth it.
For who? For guys even?
Everybody.
Oh, no. Guys.
Underwear?
Oh,
come
yeah.
On, Sia.
There are some horrible guys with like holes in their underwear and they don't
like
care.
Like Joost van der Westhuis in Houston.
See?
but you don't appreciate that. Like, you probably have designer underwear.
No, and that's why you can't compare it, though, to women with bras, because underwear is a general for men and general price, and you'd only pay more because it's a designer label. It's not as opposed to because you have to. There's some guys who freeball. There's some guys who just do boxes. There's some. Yeah, they go commando, whatever the case is.
What an interesting morning we're having. Isn't this great? Let's just actually squeeze in one or two of the things you really do need to know about. So summer is here, but that means that you've got to look out for certain things. Maybe you've had mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. I had some of those last night.
The Christmas beetles, which are very stupid and tend to fly into your forehead.
I hate them.
Christmas beetles, and what else?
Snakes.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
So if you're in Joburg, you're probably pretty much safe. But there are still places like, I mean, I live near the Melville Kopjes.
Yes.
But the biggest risk of all was living in McGregor. Mm. Whew, did I have some encounters there.
With snakes.
With the world's deadliest snake.
Tell me more.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, just in general, summer is here. It's the end of hibernation. Reptiles like snakes are becoming more active. South Africa is home to some of the most poisonous snakes. Needless to say, it's a little more than useful to be able to identify them, especially if you're on holiday or if you're familiar with the local fauna and flora.
Okay, so, give me some – I'll tell you about some of them. Go ahead.
Okay, well, the stiletto snake
– Stiletto snake?
It's actually a species consisting of 21 snakes. The most commonly found is the – bronze stiletto snake.
God, that sounds horrible.
I didn't know about this snake.
Tell me about them.
It's nocturnal, enjoys sleeping in abandoned termite mounds or under rocks and logs. After heavy rains, the snake will surface, especially on hot summer nights. And it's mainly in the northern parts of South Africa, Limpopo.
Well, you know Jane, who works here for us, she's gone up to Limpopo. She can fix the roof on her house there.
Yeah.
In Zanin. She gets snakes. You must ask her about snakes. She's told us stories about how they'll come into the house and she'll have to smash them. And they will fall out of the trees and onto people.
Yeah.
And they will crawl in while you are cooking dinner, and then you'll see it slither past your feet. I mean, listen, some wild parts of South Africa, man.
Yeah. So when I think we'd been in McGregor for about a month or so. It was very early into our time there. And I looked out the kitchen window and I saw all four of my cats in positions that I'd never seen them in before.
Like freaking out, jumping around.
No, very still, very alert, standing up, all facing in the same direction, all with their ears cupped forward, as if they were interested in something, and moving forward really slowly. Uh-oh. And I thought, what the hell? So I swung open the kitchen door, and right outside the kitchen door was a Cape Cobra, reared up.
Oh, boy. Was it facing you? Was it facing the cats?
It was facing the cats.
And it went up, and it was going to spit?
Yeah, it was ready to attack because it could see these four animals coming its way. It had and it was cornered as well.
Uh-oh.
So this is where I got really panicky. So I started calling the cats. I was like, come cats, come cats. They didn't move at all. They didn't stop staring at what they were staring at. And, oh, God, I just remember going, it's a fucking cobra. And the first thing that you get when you arrive in McGregor is like this little helper pack.
Wow, that's nice of them.
And it's...
Does someone walk around and hand them out?
Mm. Number one on the list is like three snake catchers. So I grabbed my phone, but I was shaking uncontrollably. I'm not scared of snakes. I hold them. I actually am really fascinated by them. I'm very happy to sit at someone's house who has snakes with a snake on me while we have a braai or whatever. I don't mind. But when you see the world's most deadly snake in your garden threatening your animals, it's really, really scary. Well, it's more like my cats were threatening
him. I remember
when
we were kids, there was because I grew up on a farm, my dad said, oh, no, there's a snake in the pantry or in the kitchen or something. And he came through with his shotgun and blew it to pieces.
Oh, my word. So, no, I called this guy. I'm like, guy, there's a...
He just blew its head off. My dad just blew its fucking head off. It was just, one minute it was there and then
it was
pieces.
And it's like you just don't do those sorts of things now. Now they get caught released somewhere else.
The wrangler comes and he catches and puts them in a bag. And,
yeah. So I called the guy and he was like, look, I'll be there tomorrow. So I said, it's going to be too late. But he did arrive the next day with his bicycle and his little stick.
And did he capture it?
He couldn't find it.
Oh, yeah, so it was just there. It was just hanging around. Mm,
because when this all happened and it was cornered, there was a tiny gap at the bottom of the gate. And you won't believe how a snake can flatten itself.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's where he got out into the front yard.
And none of your cats were hurt?
No.
My least favorite is a puff adder.
Those are also very common in the Western Cape especially. And the problem with those is that they're extremely lazy snakes. Mm-hmm. So you'll often stand on it before mm-hmm. you even see it.
And then it goes...
And their venom is deadly.
Yeah.
Then you get the boomslang. Now, the boomslang is...
Boomslang is a little green snake that lives in the trees with big eyes.
Yeah. My parents came home from holiday the once, and my dad had stopped for petrol on the way and checked on the water, opened up his bonnet, and there was a boomslang in the engine.
Because they go there because it's warm.
Yeah. But it kind of slunk away and they couldn't reach it. So he closed the bonnet and they carried on driving. Obviously, my mom was going nuts. But they got home and my dad said, help me get the snake out. So he was tiny. He was a tiny little sliver of a thing. I had on oven gloves. And I managed to pick him up. But then I dropped him through the bonnet and he slithered into the driveway. My dad got a bucket, etc. Took it the next day to the vet, who's a reptile specialist.
A herpetologist.
Oh, there we go. It's not for herpes. And he backed away immediately. He's like, oh my God, that's a boomslang. He's like, you would have been dead in 3 hours if mm-hmm. this thing had bitten you.
Yep.
But it was a baby. I said, but it's a tiny little thing. He said, no, they are born with all their venom.
Oh, yeah, those
evil things. The reason why it didn't bite us is because it's actually really a lot of work for them to bite. They've got to open their jaws to 180 degrees in order to expose their teeth and venom.
No, the teeth are right near the back of the... Yeah.
So it rarely does it.
But it's a hemotoxin. So what it does is it prevents the blood from coagulating. So you will die as a result of internal and external bleeding.
It's a slow death.
Hemotoxin. You get a hemotoxin, you get a cytotoxin, you get a neurotoxin. Cytotoxin is the tissue actually starts to rot.
Mm.
Hemotoxin, the blood can't coagulate. And neurotoxin, it goes straight for the nervous system and disables it.
So I phoned the hospital in Robertson just out of interest
mm-hmm.
and said, do they have anti-venom, etc.? They said, we don't actually keep it. It's got to be so fresh. Otherwise, it loses its properties, its healing properties.
Really?
Yeah. Oof. So they keep it in only really big big hospitals. And they've got to keep refreshing it and throwing out the old stuff.
Well, apparently the chances of death from the puff adder bite are actually small, but any fatalities that occur are most likely as a result of poor medical care and secondary infection.
Oh, I see.
Hmm. So there's some useful information. I don't like any of these. The worst, most scary snake of all, by far, always will be, is the black mamba. You see one of those, that'll be the last thing you see.
Yeah.
It's no messing
Thanks,
around.
Thanks, guys. Thanks. This is a comforting thought.
Black mamba.
The black mamba, maximum length of 4.5 meters.
Mm-hmm. 4 point. Just think about that. Yeah. 4 meters of snake.
It's Africa's largest venomous snake.
It is extremely venomous.
It is fairly hard to come across, rather shy. But if it feels threatened, a black mamba will strike repeatedly.
Oh, goodness, okay, I can't.
Sia's not having a good day here.
If my body's ever found near a snake, just understand that, no, it wasn't the venom that killed me. I just died because I just saw one.
That's what I've always said about sharks. If I saw a shark while swimming, I'd have a heart attack.
Rest in peace to me. It was great knowing you. It was great being on Earth, but that's not happening right now.
I just want to throw this in quickly. The venom of a black mamba can deliver... by the way, the bite can give 100 to 120 milligrams of venom. In average, the maximum dose recorded is 400 milligrams. It's reported that before anti-venom was widely available, the mortality rate was 100%.
Mm. Yeah, and they say if you have been bitten and you're driving to a hospital or being driven, any form of energy or activity or panic – is going to cause the venom to spread quicker. So you have to literally lie really still and keep your heart rate low so that it doesn't circulate really quickly around your body. It's like really hard not to panic, but yeah, that's what they say.
God. Okay. The black mamba is popularly regarded as the most dangerous and feared snake in the world. Attacks on humans by black mambas are rare. But when they occur, it's 100% fatality usually.
And multiple strikes.
Hmm. Terrifying.
Can we wrap this up, please?
God. You know, I sometimes...
with tears in my eyes.
When I'm walking in my house at night, I'll stand on one of my dog's toys, and I just, for any reason, I always imagine that it's a snake.
Mm.
I shit myself. Because he'll lie... Yeah, he leaves these little toys lying around.
Yeah.
I always go, oh, shit, it's a snake! Even though it's not a snake. The kind
but
of
you also don't like those... walking dragon things.
Komodo dragons.
Please, let's leave that one.
All right.
Okay, that put a stop to it.
Yeah. Let's just leave that alone.
It worked.
That's enough. That's enough of snakes and reptiles for today, all right?
Oh, my skin is crawling.
My God. All right. Last week we had Darren Graham and Happy Makumalangidi, you remember, from Proudly South African, ahead of their launch for the festive season campaign with a message of buying local. Today and for the next few weeks, we'll be continuing to help spread that message, and we'll highlight some great South African entrepreneurs that can benefit from your support whenever you buy local, especially this festive season. Hopefully, you'll continue to buy local all year round. So this morning, we're joined by Rob Urquhart from the Harambee Youth Employment Accelerator and Benji Kutsir from Empty Trips, two entrepreneurs who are breaking the mold of what it means to be successful in business in South Africa today. Good morning to you. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Gareth.
Good. How are things looking?
Good, thanks, Gareth.
Excellent. No, all right, very, very nice. So let's just talk about Empty Trips for a start. Tell me about Empty Trips, an AI-enabled transport marketplace. What does that even mean?
Yeah, exactly. So in simple terms, basically what we do is we use the volumetric dimensions of cargo.
Mm-hmm.
So you're thinking commodity, mine heaps, containers. We match that space to the empty space on a truck, train, or plane. And by doing that, it's almost like a dating site for freight and space. We try to tack...
Oh, so unused space in a truck or in a train or whatever else. Unused space gets put to use by this AI that
this
you...
This algorithm. It's mathematical brilliant. Match.
But that's brilliant because I always drive past these trucks on the highway and I wonder how full they are.
Yeah. You should actually take a picture if you see an empty truck and shame them. So I've created like this whole movement around it that in South Africa, it's a $500 billion industry, transport and logistics. Globally, it's about $8.1 trillion. And they estimate about a third of vehicles run their gross distances empty. So if you think of the quantum of just the wasted space and the cost and then the carbon emissions.
Because
and then
you're using the same amount of fuel.
Exactly.
You're going the same distance, taking up as much room on the road, frightening all the other motorists.
Mm.
Into these huge trucks.
And I mean, it's not just the wasted costs for the transport or the user, but it's also for government. I mean, it's about 99 cents per ton kilometer damage to the road by a truck. So to know that the truck's on the road and doesn't need to be on the road, we're actually indirectly paying for the damage by just sub-optimizing the matching.
But surely a truck has to be empty at some point because it has to drop the stuff off and then go back.
Yeah, it depends on cross-contamination. So you can't typically go put sugar now in a coal train. Right.
No, sure.
But there are times where it's just literally companies don't talk to one another. So I say it's like a shared economy on steroids. We are unable the two biggest competitors to talk to one another online virtually, anonymously, which protects their brands. It avoids a lot of collusion in the industry and back end.
That's fantastic. How long did it take you to get this going? That's a very brilliant idea.
So I quit my job at the end of 2016 and I started working on this beginning of last year.
What were you doing before then?
Management consulting.
Okay.
I was with a firm called the Boston Consulting Group, and I basically did a lot of turnarounds and restructuring types of projects. And before that, investment banking. Hey, so just love math, love some models, and built me an algorithm.
That's amazing. All right, so less trucks, less collisions, less road damage, less fuel wasted, less infections, emissions, all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me to be a very good idea. And have you received support from government?
No. So I raised capital from a listed company in October last year on the JSE. I was very fortunate. There's very few founders in South Africa, especially tech founders, that are attacking the enterprise space that can raise capital within their 6 months of scoping, development, and launching. So it was a very aggressive build-up to that. And it was also an accidental funding round because I'd been said no to many, many, many times. Because it's too high risk, it's still too early stage, you're attacking like established big businesses that don't like disruption.
Do they tell you that the margins are too small?
At times, but for us, it's because you build a platform and that's your only infrastructure, right? Yes, the technology costs a lot to build, but once you've built it once, it's not like you have to go reinvest in so many trucks. So I say, well, we currently have about 5,000 trucks on our portal. We're the largest transport company in Africa within 2 years without owning a single vehicle.
That's amazing.
The only asset we have is the portal and our people, obviously. Right? I have to be diplomatic, my people, when they're performing.
Okay, so how many people do you have?
So full-time we have 3, and then we've got 7 freelancers that work with us. So we love the freelance model. I think it's the most economic way to build a business. And the quicker you get to break even as a startup, the quicker you can raise bigger capital, if that's your goal, not my goal to overcapitalize my business at all. But it also just helps you and creates you, I don't know, it enables more innovation when you're not stressed and wondering yeah, about runway sure. and paying salaries and all these
but
things.
But I'm curious, before you came along with this idea, these companies were happy to just waste, because essentially that's what it is. It was wastage. It was a huge amount of just unnecessary expenditure.
Well, it's also just an exchange for O2 for CO2, right? Because you're literally transporting oxygen around. previously, I think the disjointedness in the industry and this competitive will between the companies to actually not share data was one of their biggest downfalls. And then you got these pop-ups of these bigger companies acquiring all of the smaller companies. And a lot of BEE CSR spend has also been on small to medium enterprises buying trucks, which is probably the worst investment you can possibly make. When I said that to Supergroup CEO, he was very uncomfortable. But I was like, you should shift your business a little bit, right? You need to go asset light. So the only way to do that is to, by click of a button, have access to 5,000 trucks. Why own them, right?
How hard is it as a woman, Benji, for you to have got involved in the transport industry? Because I can't imagine there are a lot of women in the transport industry, certainly not at CEO level.
Well, self-appointed CEO, right?
Yeah. There aren't any. Are there any others?
Well, there are a few women that I respect in the transport and logistics industry, but they won't typically be the CEO. They're probably in like senior management, especially in the bigger corporates.
Right.
Very male-dominated, still very Afrikaans-dominated, which is fine because I am Afrikaans, so that does help. But it's actually quite refreshing. When you go into an established transport and logistics company or a trucker or even the rail operators and you're a fresh team of dominated by women, you're bringing innovation to the industry, you're trying to enable them, right? Because I'm trying to help them get better yield in their investment. Better utilization is better return.
Yeah.
So it's actually been quite an easy sell. I mean, there has been sometimes I've been escorted out of buildings by security and all of that for saying things and not keeping my mouth shut when I should.
Yeah, you seem pretty fearless.
But besides from that, it's been really, really positive in general. I think it's refreshing for the market.
Who developed the algorithm?
So I wrote the algorithm Excel.
That's brilliant.
Thank you. It's a multiple if function, and then it's macro-enabled with a geolocation mapping over 100 kilometers of the origin and 100 kilometers of the destination, and tries to find a spatial and a directional match.
Oh, that makes my head hurt.
Right. So many terms there.
And now we've even optimized it for like wagon routes. So
do you know what the rest of us do? We primates. We just climbed down off the trees.
I'm currently finishing off my 2015 tax on Excel. Just because it takes
I've got a model for you.
God.
So I bought it in Excel and then I came across.
How long did that take you?
Sure, I worked on the algorithm for a good 6 months because I was learning about geolocation plugins from Google and all of
that. And how do you test it?
You just run scenarios, if functions, right? It's in Excel, if function can do basically anything. If X, Y, Z match Y. If da, 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 da equals, hooray, happy. You know, you can do anything. And that basically is also used in by my CTO and developer. And he's the real brains because he found flaws in my algorithm, right? So,
shocker.
I know.
How rude.
No. And I was like, I'm personally hurt here. But anyway, and then he converted it into an online portal. So he took that and then coded it. So basically, a lot of coders actually prefer working off of Excel first because if you can write a formula for it, they can write code for it, right? So. So that's very powerful. And that's kind of where it started. And now we recently changed the algorithm for rail. So it's the first digital rail exchange globally.
How hard is that compared to road?
Okay, so there, that's one of the companies that got thrown out of the building from biosecurity.
Transnet?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not their biggest favorite because I've obviously highlighted the inefficiencies on the rail network, that indirectly they're responsible for the road damage, for 30% of the road deaths on the N3 are probably trucks that didn't need to be on the road. So I've been very vocal and I've been a real rail evangelist. And that's also differentiated us because no one's trying to Uberize rail freight. We're the first ones. So, for example, Howard Buffett from BNSF. Is in contact with us now. And that's quite cool as a South African startup to say one of the largest rail companies in America
amazing.
Is willing to work with us. Even though we're still broke, we're still,
running break-even.
No, we've made money, but everything goes straight back into dev, right? Sure. Or people, or marketing, or whatever the case may be. Because my mindset's very different. When a venture capitalist contacts me, I'm like,
You don't want to give them any, right?
No, it's not that. I'm not greedy about my equity at all. I raise capital through a corporate, but not a corporate VC, because I believe their model's broken. They're building a bubble. All they're after is big raises. It gives big valuations that have no value principles behind them. And then thirdly, they charge huge management fees that are 7 to 10%, which is in America more than what you'd pay on a bank loan. So I'm a little bit like anti.
So who would you take money from?
I love seed funders and angel funders, people that have been there, can give advice, understands the struggle, the bipolar days that you have with the office and all of that. So seed funders and angels.
Is this thing scalable internationally?
So it's a copy and paste into any country, basically. So that's the goal.
Where are you going next?
Ideally Australia. So you can see we chase commodities, mining products and agri because it's usually payload. And large payload means it's heavy and bulky and it's traveling a far distance. So that's great for rail in particular because what do you move by rail? It's usually the heaviest stuff that you don't want to put by road. And it's also safer by rail in general in terms of collisions. I mean, when last did you hear about a train being hijacked? Unless it's a high-speed train on a movie in Hollywood, right?
Yeah,
you know,
it's true.
It doesn't really happen. But trucks, all the time. So very big opportunity in Australia. Also from the mining sector, a lot of interest because it's an aggregator, right? Through a portal like this, they get access to multiple operators, multiple pricing, which overall leads to price savings and profits for them. So it makes their lives a lot easier. Well, we try.
And who is in this? Just you?
No. So I am 76% shareholder still through my trust. Then my CTO is 4% sweat equity. Herman Strauss, he's in Bloom.
Right.
And then 20% is Unicorn Capital listed on the JSE.
Very, very impressive. And this is a proudly South African business and idea.
Proudly South African business. When we launched last year, we were proudly part of them, as well, of course, still today. And it was, I think, one of the proudly South African events last year. April was my very first event as a founder. I was the only employee, obviously, standing by my little stand and handing out little pamphlets. And people not understanding what you're trying to do.
Did people get it quickly or did they take a while to understand?
No, you just say, see that empty truck? I can fill it with an algorithm like dating. And they're like, oh, like Tinder for freight.
Tinder for freight.
If you were on Dragon's Den, you'd win all of the money.
No, I doubt that.
I think you would.
I would take it.
All right, let's give Rob some attention. I don't want to make it all about Benji. I mean, it doesn't seem fair. So Harambee Youth Employment Accelerator is an independent, not-for-profit social enterprise that works with individual businesses, government agencies, local and international donors, industry sector associations, youth-serving organizations, assessment specialists, behavioral change experts, and technology providers. Now, that's a huge mouthful, but essentially one of the biggest problems we have in this country is youth unemployment.
Correct.
And you're looking at solving that, Rob.
Correct. So we, to build on I think, what Benji was saying, since we were talking about dating, Harambee is a combination of a dating agency and a finishing school for unemployed young people. So we have this massive unemployment problem in South Africa.
Sure.
For youth, 48%, roughly one in two youth. unemployed. Yet we see that there are vacancies in the economy, even in a low growth or a slow growth economy such as South Africa. Right. There are vacancies and there are sectors where jobs are growing. And our work, I think, is really to try and get young people into those jobs as quickly and as cost effectively as possible and get them engaged in activities that will continue to grow their employability over a period of time.
All right, so explain to me, like I'm a complete idiot, how exactly it works. Do people have to come and join your database? And you farm them into the system?
Sure. So we have a MOBI site, a zero-rated MOBI site, where mm-hmm. an unemployed young person can log on. I think we should also say we're dealing very specifically with youth from poor households. Mm-hmm. In the that's our kind of our focus area. But you log on to our MOBI site, you join the kind of Harambee network. We will conduct a range of assessments with you, some of those over the phone, some of those in person with you. We collect that data. We're able to use, again, picking off Benji, we use algorithms to understand matches to particular opportunities.
What kind of jobs are we talking about?
So we're talking about jobs all the way from the retail hospitality sector through to cruise liners, through to financial service sector jobs, business process outsourcing. We've worked across the economy in placing young people into jobs.
And what did you do before this?
Like Benji, I was also a management consultant for 14 years.
Wow. And where were you consulting?
I was with an organization called the Resolve Group for a number of years, and then landed up at Ernst & Young EY for a last stage.
And this is more fun for you, or is this more challenging? And do you have any regrets about making the move into doing something like this?
Not at all. I mean, it's purpose-driven work, I think, as Benji has said. It's work that you wake up and you do every day that's good for the soul and kind of keeps you going. And it's good for South Africa, right?
Do you have any kind of measure for how much, of course it's good for South Africa, but how good is it? Because it is hard to find people and it's hard to find work for those people. I mean, you're essentially doing what the Department of Labor should be doing.
We're filling gaps I think we're filling a number of different gaps. I think the education system is not seeing the kind of transition rates and throughput rates that it should be doing.
Why do you think that is?
I think there's a number of reasons to see that. I think that part of what the curriculum is focusing on is that kind of future proofed is potentially some of that. I think changing the kind of assessment standard of what a good kind of mark is it doesn't provide a good signal to the market. And so we see employers saying, look, we don't trust the credibility of a school leaver certificate, and you've got to ask why that is the case. So I think there are a number of kind of issues to that. And then I think, you know, the sort of post-schooling education and training system has its own challenges, particularly the technical vocational colleges, and that content, I think we hear a lot, isn't aligned to what employers are saying that they need.
Someone sent me a list from the World Economic Forum of the top 10 declining and top 10 emerging jobs, and I wanted to know what your opinion on these are. Declining jobs: data entry clerks, accounting, bookkeeping, and payroll clerks, administrative and executive secretaries, assembly and factory workers, client information and customer service workers, accountants and auditors. I wouldn't have thought they would be there.
Oh, no, you can automate that? Yeah, you can automate that.
Algorithms.
No, the algorithm.
Yeah.
Benji's busy putting you out of work, accountants and auditors.
Sorry,
material
guys.
Recording and stock keeping clerks. Well, clearly that's something that you'll know something about there as well, and that's easy to replace. General operational manager and post service clerks. Postal, obviously. Postal as in, you know, post and telecommunications. Then the top 10 emerging ones: data analysts and scientists, mm-hmm. AI and machine learning specialists, mm-hmm. general and operational managers of a different kind, software and application designers and analysts, big data specialists, digital transformation specialists, new technology specialists, and information technology services.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an
interesting.
What
do you make of those?
I think it's an interesting list, because I mean, I think there's a number of management positions in there that are looking like they're under fire. But I think equally, I would contest some of that. But I would also say certainly the data analysts, and we're about to embark on a project in getting unemployed young people into entry level data analyst positions that don't require you to go through a 3-4 year university degree. And we've seen young people have the potential to do these jobs, right? We've seen kids from Orange Farm, one of the most dispossessed areas in Johannesburg, get into the We Think Code bootcamp, which doesn't require you to have maths or science. Actually, it's just about it's just your predilection for that kind of work. So I think these jobs have opportunity as well as cost. They can be job creating,
100%,
not job destroying. And then I think, you know, the knowledge worker piece, I would contest that a little bit. I think there's opportunities to get youth engaged in collecting data, and getting them into a foothold into those types of digitally enabled jobs. That's quite powerful, and we've seen that in the, Gauteng recently did a township audit of 20,000 township-based businesses. That was all run by youth in community who could go out, have the credibility in their communities to kind of collect that data. So these types of opportunities, I think, are dynamic and quite exciting.
Yeah, and obviously technology helps you to match up people with jobs and so
absolutely.
On in a way that could never have been done before.
Absolutely.
I think there's a bit of a reality check that we need to do in South Africa, though. I think those jobs are very valid and they're very sexy if you think of a more developed, systemized economy.
Sure.
South Africa is still very old school. So I think for the next 10 to 15 years, Harambe will be very safe in terms of placing people in the more mundane, old school kind of roles, because our corporates don't like change. Mm. They don't like changing to systems. They don't like investing in them. It's very valid what Jack Ma said, that if big business doesn't change the way they do things, because they literally are like Goliath still, you know, these sexy titles aren't really going to pop up. And when you do and they put someone in that position, trust me, they're probably not qualified.
Yeah, I'm interested
because they aren't these humans and they say really.
I'm curious about what both of you think about big business at the moment and these huge corporations. I mean, everybody's talking about job creation. Mm. So, Rob, in particular, this is something that must interest you.
Yeah.
The jobs are going to be created by smaller businesses, right?
Yes.
And the jobs are going to be created by individuals themselves who want to set up shop or try and make a difference or try and bring in a little bit of income. How are we faring in that respect?
I think there's work to be done. I mean, I think there's I think there are corporates out there who are doing very good work. Mm-hmm. And I think of First Round, I think in particular, has made some strong commitments in the next 2 years in that regard. But I think you're right, Gareth. I mean, I think the small and medium enterprise space really is a space that has the potential to absorb young people. But it faces a lot of very systemic kind of constraints to growth. I mean, you run your own business, Benji, you know what that's kind of like. And that's regulatory stuff in some cases.
It always seems to me that when people talk about our economy, they talk about business, big business, that is, government, and labor. Mm. And they think like they're, you know, writing Karl Marx Das Kapital. They're not thinking about the way that the modern economy is constituted, which is out of very many more small individual parts that actually play a much larger role than those three behemoths ever can, and that are much more nimble and that are much more change adapted. Those are not things that you can turn easily.
No. I mean, I would also think that if corporates are going to get some of this stuff right, they've got to think about how they can backwards engineer some of their supply chains to those small and medium enterprises. And I think that's an area which I don't think they're getting right across the board at this point.
I mean, I can speak on that perspective. So one of the very big companies, I won't mention a name just for protection of our relationship, but they're a huge alcohol company. And we did a whole case study for them to remove about 1,300 trucks off the road for them running up to Lusaka delivering some kind of alcohol, and 39 million rand just in the one type of bottles that they're sending a year in savings and shifted onto rail.
Wow.
Great for the environment, great for social impact, the road damage, no one pays the tolls in Zambia, so the roads are shot, Bybridge border posts are stuck for 3-4 days, so it could really alleviate a lot. First question I was asked after presented it, what is my BEE level status? It needs to be level 2. Mm. So as a founder, that's very demotivating because you're the one that's risked all of your savings. Mm. You've worked day and night. You've
and
aged tenfold.
And you don't
tenfold,
give two shits about the politics.
Yeah. And you don't care about the politics. And I'm like, yeah, but you know how many people I'm employing and how many people I'm going to employ with this, this kind of contract.
Short-term thinking, right?
And it's not that level 4 is enough, because that you think, oh, level 4 will be enough because you're still a small to medium enterprise. It's not. They want level 2 because if they their BEE points. So then you demotivate an entrepreneur that's taken risks that can innovate a whole industry.
I mean, I would, if you came to see me, if you came to see me, I'd just make you Minister of Transport. Solve all our problems. My God. Yeah. Everyone would get to work in this country. We've got such transport issues. Mm-hmm. And I think underutilization of the amount of vehicles and space and potential that we have. I mean, that's what you're doing. You're filling those gaps.
I mean, if you look at Transnet, it's estimated about 9.7 billion rand a year is being left on the table by underutilized trains, because you can't access the train. Try and get hold of TFR. You can't get them on the phone. And even as a small to medium enterprise, you won't get a guarantee that's needed to secure an account with Transnet. So even if you were willing to say, all my cargo moves from Durban to Joburg by rail, you can't do that. You can't even get access. So only big business can. So what happens? Small business defaults to trucks. Trucks are more expensive. Their products are less competitive. So it's like a vicious cycle. Small business actually can't compete against big business, you know? So it is systemic. Mm. It really is a systemic issue of monopolistic SOEs.
But you know what? If you're a brilliant business person, you will find solutions to all of these problems. And the idiots who've created the problems will end up becoming irrelevant.
Well, we hope. From your lips to God's ears.
I'm holding thumbs for both of you. I think it's terrific what you're doing. Benji and Rob, what a pleasure to have you here. Proudly South African. For more information on Proudly South African, you can visit www.proudlysa.co.za, or you can visit their new online store for their only locally made products. That's at www.rsamade.co.za. Congrats to both of you on starting these incredible businesses. I hope you continue to have huge success.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Donald Trump would say, huge success. Very, very nice to meet you both. All right, it's just after 8 o'clock. In a little while, we'll meet another kind of South African businessman, Alessandro Khojane, who I'm very pleased to speak to. If you've ever been to Jameli, you'll know what I'm talking about. Alessandro is a real... He's a maverick. That's the only way to explain it. So he's going to pop in and we'll talk to him about the incredible successes that he's had and find out a little bit about his story too. It's always nice to meet the great business people who are taking South African business forward. And thank you very much to Rob and to Benji for popping by this morning. If you want to know more, go to Proudly SA and you can hear the whole story. Very, very nice, Sia. Been busy this morning and it's not over yet.
Busy days.
Yes, stick around. There's a whole lot more coming. CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com.